Hello and welcome, my friend, to the Minnesota Gardening Podcast. It is my honor to have you here with us today. My name is Brad Tabke, the host of the Minnesota Gardening Podcast, and I have an extraordinary treat for you right before Christmas. Happy holidays to all who are listening, and we have an icon of weather and climate in Minnesota. You hear him often on Minnesota Public Radio, even though he's retired now, but it was just an awesome treat to have Mark Seeley with us today to talk about just this absolutely crazy, goofy weather that we are experiencing right now, what we can expect for the remainder of winter, and I promise you, you will probably not like the forecast for the remainder of our winter. No matter if you like winter or hate winter, it's going to be middling. So we'll see what your reaction is to that. And then also climate. We talk a lot about climate and where things are going and what's happening here, specifically in Minnesota, and what you need to know about that. So here is Mark Seeley talking about the 2023-24 winter weather.
All right. I am beyond honored to have Mark Seeley here with us today to talk climate and winter outlook and just the awesome things that we have going on. That is Minnesota, and his iconic voice is here to help us talk through those things today. So, Mark, thank you so much for being with us today. Will you give folks an update as to what you're up to now?
Sure. Thanks, Brad. I'm retired. I retired after 40 years at the University of Minnesota on the faculty in 2018. So I'm about 5 years retired now. I still write the weekly blog for the University of Minnesota called Minnesota Weather Talk, which is issued every Friday. It's partially based on what I talk about on Minnesota Public Radio every Friday on Morning Edition. I'm in my 32nd year of doing that. And then I still occasionally talk weather on Almanac, the Channel 2 TPT program. And I write, I'm in my 20th year of writing a monthly column for the Minnesota Farmer magazine. So I still talk weather with Minnesota farmers. And then I get to enjoy a lot more time, though, with family and grandkids and things like that. So,
got it. Well, thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate your time, and you've always had just a wonderful perspective on everything weather-wise in Minnesota, and just an incredible knowledge. So, thanks for being here with us. Let's first start with just the crazy weather that we're having right now. Like, we're going to have evidently around 50 for Christmas and New Christmas Eve and that kind of thing. How unprecedented, or how does this look as to where we're at today?
Yeah, this is remarkable. We have had occasions, although quite rare, where we've gone the entire month of December without much snow cover and with very little soil frost. This year is remarkable in we're right in the midst of a very strong episode of El Nino, which I would remind listeners of your podcast that that's the episode in the equatorial Pacific Ocean when there's abnormally warm waters present, and it tends to disrupt weather patterns across the North American continent. And in so doing, it has historically brought milder winters to us in the north central states. And so that's definitely in play, and partially the reason we're having such a mild December. It is a little bit more remarkable and a little bit more exceptional, Brad, when you think about how widespread geographically this is. So, in other words, we're not just experiencing a mild and somewhat snowless December in a small area of Minnesota, but we're pretty much experiencing that close to a statewide basis. And that is extremely rare. We were talking about that earlier today, in fact, with the Minnesota State Climate Office, which is, of course, the record keepers of all the data back to the 19th century. And the closest analogy we could find for that historically is, of course, way beyond our lifetime. It's the winter of 1877 and 1878.
Wow.
And And what was remarkable about that winter still remains, by, I might add, still remains to this day on a temperature scale, the mildest December, January, and February that we have ever recorded as a state. And the only year in which our small grain crops were planted in the month of February of 1878. So the mild weather was really remarkable for that particular 19th century episode. I doubt that it's going to play out to be equivalent to that as we migrate into January and February, although I think almost all meteorologists in the state, bar none, are astounded by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration outlooks that all suggest we're going to stay mild through mid-January, which is an extraordinary long spell to stay mild.
And when you say mild, does that mean just like closer, like 5 degrees above average, or is that like above freezing the way we've been so far in December?
Well, on the scales used to categorize this, that suggests we're probably going to be on the order of a 5 to maybe 8 degrees warmer than normal right through the period, which is remarkable to be so persistently above normal. I mean, obviously on individual days, as when we had those days earlier this month where a lot of observers reported an afternoon high in the 50s, and some reported an afternoon high in the 60s. We even had 68 degrees out at Canby, Minnesota, which is kind of remarkable. Those are more like, you know, 20 or 30 degrees above normal. So we may still see a few occasions where on a daily basis we're 15 or 20 degrees above normal. But I'm talking about averaging over the whole period. And right. That's just striking. I mean, so, you know, it's been difficult. Those that covet, and we have a lot of Minnesotans that covet the winter season for its recreational possibilities and other kinds of things, they're pretty darn frustrated right now. And I, you know, I don't blame them. I don't know how long it's going to be before all our lake ice is safe. You know what I mean? And then I don't know about the soils, but it sure looks like, I mean, the soil temperature measurements I've seen is our soils are only frozen down just a few inches, Brad. You know, I mean, they're in fact, you could break through the frozen crust if you took a hard spade to it. You could probably get through the top 2 or 3 inches of frozen soil and get down into thawed soil. And of course, these rains we've had this month, one sign of that is I think the rains in some of our soils have been soaked up. You know, I think they've gone into the ground, which is really good because we have a lot of areas of the state, as you well know from this last growing season, that are still deficient in terms of their soil moisture recharge.
Right, absolutely. And with temperature-wise, like I saw a map earlier today that International Falls is running, I think it was 11 and a half or 12 degrees above average for the month of December. And that's just astounding and has massive impacts up there. And then there's a friend of mine is in southern Minnesota, and they had a lavender plant out in their herb garden, and the lavender plant started blooming today. So it is insane how this is all happening. So you said you think that we'll be in this warmer type pattern through the middle of January. Then what happens then?
Well, it's a roll of the dice. As the climate is changing, and we all know we've got multiple signals of climate change in Minnesota, it's hard to gauge. I think if I had to say as a meteorologist, to expect this level of abnormality to persist for 2 complete months, December and January combined, is probably very unrealistic. It would certainly, historically, if we look at the historical behavior of climate in the state of Minnesota, for a 2-month anomaly of that magnitude, it would probably be less than a 5 or 10% chance, Brad, but it could still occur. I do think we're going to have more outbreaks of below normal temperatures. I have no idea what's going to happen snow-wise, though. And that is a true wild card. In fact, if we look at the nine, if we look at the nine ensemble models that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration uses to look out in the mid-range from 2 weeks out to 3 months or so, if we look at those nine models, they suggest a mixture. Some of them are suggesting we will see more snow the second half of January and maybe normal snow or even above normal snow by February. But also some of them are suggesting we're going to stay in this dry pattern until we get into early spring. So that, in other words, we're simply going to have a dry, dry winter. But see, when you get mixed signals like that, you from the models, you don't quite know what to hang your hat on. It's much easier as a meteorologist if all the models are agreeing, that is, they're honing in on the same solution. But that's not the case this winter.
So with that, there's this strong, really strong El Nino that we're seeing affecting our weather this winter. Does that make everything more unpredictable? Is it climate change that makes everything more unpredictable, or is it just some combination therein?
I think the detailed answer to that question is complex. I think having a strong El Nino present that the National Weather Service is going to continue to hang their hat on a milder than normal winter. And that's because the likelihood is very high. It's probably an 80 or 90% probability that this persistent above normal temperature, as we look at blocks of weeks and months as they go by, is going to be a strong signal right through March. I wouldn't be surprised. So there's a lot of confidence in that particular aspect of the climate outlook. Where we have really uncertain and little confidence is how is the precipitation season going to go? Are we going to have more rains as we've had in some El Nino winters? Are we going to have as many rains as we have snows? Are we going to have as many midwinter rains as we have snows? I'm pretty confident that we're not going to see much persistent snow cover. Even when we get snow, we're probably going to see persistent snow cover maybe only in the northern third of the state. And that might be second half of winter, like late January into early March. I think the southern half of the state is going to be dominated by intermittent snow cover if we get it. And of course, that's problematic for gardeners and for farmers in that especially those that rely on having some kind of a blanket of snow on the landscape when we have those sub-zero temperature excursions. That's another thing I think they're pretty highly confident about. I don't think we're going to see any, not to say we won't see any sub-zero, we probably will, but I don't think we're going to see anything like record-breaking low temperatures the rest of this winter. I just don't think that's in the cards. If we get sub-zero, of course, everybody will be afraid of that because they've grown so used to the mild spells.
Right.
But as far as insulation and the values of snow cover, I don't think farmers and gardeners are going to realize much of it this winter.
Got it. And that's really highly problematic, especially, well, if your predictions turn true there on that forecast where we don't see really deep, cold winter, that's where it causes a lot of problems with people's plants, especially if they're moderately hardy in the area when you don't have any snow cover. It's the soil, especially if it's as dry as we have been, if it stays that way, it really takes on that temperature, and it would come out of spring with a lot of dead plants on the other side. And so with farming,
we can have a lot of winter injury. We can have, if we have rain that turns into ice, then we have ice sheeting and we have suffocation of a lot of plants. So there's a lot of risks associated with this type of winter that could materialize. We'll keep our fingers crossed that they don't, but it could be problematic the rest of the way. There's no question about that.
Got it. So as we're looking at this, where does this winter fit on a more global scale? Is everyone across the country, North America, is everybody seeing this type of warm winter as well? Or are they seeing other types of fluctuations? Like what are other folks seeing around the country?
Well, it's likely, I mean, if the El Nino signature, as well as some of the recent climate trend signatures persist, our friends up along the Atlantic seaboard are probably going to see a very wet winter, wetter than normal. Our friends in the southern plain states and the southeastern states are probably going to see a wet winter combined with excursions of below normal temperature. And then the West Coast is a wild card. I mean, the West Coast normally gets quite wet. And of course, they would look forward to that. They're always looking to make up for all those drought years they went through.
Right.
And then Canada, now we haven't talked about Canada, but our neighbors to the north have an even stronger signature of mild temperatures in the winter than we do. So the higher latitudes in Canada are likely to see some remarkably warm temperatures. There's been some temperatures inside the Arctic Circle in the winter season that have gone up into the 40s. I think there's even been some low 50s, which when you think about it, when you think about the winter season where they probably only have, like 2 to 3 hours of daylight, you know, and so they're not getting much from the sun's energy, but they still get up to 40 or 50 degrees. That's just absolutely remarkable. I don't know about the rest. When we look at what Europe might have and what Asia might have, I haven't paid much attention to those. So I'm really not well versed into what the signature can look like. They're talking about this El Nino, though, in terms of strength, having somewhat of an equivalent signal to what was measured in 1983, 1998, and 2015, which were some of the very strong. And of course, as I said earlier, 1877 was a very strong one. But what they're very uncertain about is how long is it going to last? Is it going to last through the Northern Hemisphere spring and carry over into summer? Most of the speculation is it may last into the spring, but it's very unlikely to carry over into the summer, that it's likely to revert back towards a neutral condition, or maybe even go even more extreme back to a La Nina condition.
Wow. So does that mean we're going to have, I'm trying to remember how it works with La Nina. Do we have a dry summer or do we have a wet summer?
Yeah, we could be drier if it goes the other way. We could have drier than normal. And of course, after having four consecutive drought years in Minnesota, you know, what's striking for your podcast members here to note is this amplified variability that we're experiencing with climate change, where the swings in temperature seem to be greater, and the swings in wet, 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 or dry, 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 they seem to be more magnified. This is really in evidence when we look at the recent last 5 years, you know, or last 4 years. 2019 was the wettest year in Minnesota state history, and that's all the way back to 1858. We had across an observation network that incorporates over 1,500 volunteer observers. We had an average precipitation in the state of Minnesota in 2019 that was for the first time over 35 inches. And this is remarkable. We went through that, and then we started turning dry in 20, drier in 21, drier in 22, and now drier in 23. So these big swings, I think that we may see a correction in 2024 and actually have a wetter than normal year after having four consecutive drier than normal years. I need to make sure for your listeners that this I'm talking about in a statewide context. I'm not talking about a specific location in the state, but taking all of the state data as a whole.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that would be, if that comes to fruition, that would be very, very welcome news to a lot of folks. And our luck, we'll probably just have, you know, really wet spring so that we can't get out in the fields and can't get out in the garden and do things until late again this year. But that's better than dry for sure.
It's better. It's better. Yeah. We have to keep reminding ourselves it's better than dry because all the perennial vegetation And all those trees that we highly value, they went through an awfully dry year in 2023. And they need to see some of that get going the other way so that the deeper root zones for those plants can get restored and have more moisture in them.
So, Mark, let's talk a little bit, I'm sure we could talk for hours about it, but about just climate change in general and how it's affecting Minnesota and what people can and should know about climate change, because we're obviously seeing the warmest years that we've experienced in at least recent history. And see, can you give a little understanding from your perspective as to what's happening and a little bit about why?
Sure. The two attributes that I like to emphasize, Brad, that sometimes are under everybody's radar, but they're really important for Minnesota. First and foremost is our climate is changing at a very rapid pace, so that when we measure the temperature change or the precipitation change now in time steps of, say, a decade, we measure the change in time steps of a passing decade. What we're seeing is a measure of change in Minnesota that used to take thousands of years to occur. So in other words, to see the full-scale change of, say, minimum temperature in February, which in many parts of Minnesota has changed by 5 to 7 degrees. That 5 to 7 degree change in a core winter month historically used to take thousands of years to occur, and we're seeing it occur in a matter of decades. Or where we see a 43% change in annual precipitation. See, a 43% change in annual precipitation used to take thousands of years to occur. But so the pace of change in our backyard is remarkable. That's because a lot of people, especially diehard conservative Minnesotans, they'll argue, well, the planet Earth has seen a changing climate for hundreds of millions of years. And indeed, they're quite correct. But the pace of that change that's been documented over hundreds of millions of years was far more gradual than what the pace of change is today. And then, you know, the other thing is that our seasons are changing remarkably. You know, the so-called distinct seasonality that we used to love in Minnesota, especially the shoulder seasons of spring and autumn, they're changing remarkably. And we now have, for example, for public health consideration, we now have a mold and allergy season that can extend into November and December, whereas formerly it would get cut off by the climate, by the abrupt change in the climate that would occur in October or something like that. Or we're seeing like lake and soil freezing. We're seeing whole scale changes in lake and soil freezing in Minnesota. That is just not the same regime. They're not freezing as early in the autumn as they used to, and they're thawing out much quicker in the spring than they used to. And we're seeing changes in, well, for example, the Minnesota Landscape Architect Association and the Nursery Association, they're seeing the changes in our plant hardiness zones, you know, so that our array of plant material that we can now landscape with in terms of zone 4 or zone 5 has expanded. So there's far more to choose from because our climate is changing so rapidly. Or how we manage drainage, what we put in for storm sewer runoff systems, what we put in for culvert capacities on our roads and highways, what we put in for farmer tile drainage in our agricultural soils. All of those criteria are changing because our precip is changing so fast. The recurrence interval, for example, for a 5-inch rain or a 6-inch rain is much, much closer in time than it used to be, where you might only see it once every 10 years or 20 years. Now you're going to see it once every other year or something like that. And you have to have adapted to the capacity to handle that. And so anyway, the pace of change is remarkable and really commands our attention, that we adapt to it as fast as we can, and that we also find ways to help mitigate or slow down the pace of change. We're geographically in the mid-latitudes here in Minnesota. And if you look at it geographically and you look at the pace of climate change, it's far more pronounced in the mid-latitudes and higher latitudes than it is in the subtropical latitudes. And if we're going to continue to do the same things that we've grown up doing and manage our natural resources, manage our gardens and agricultural soils, we've got to find ways to adapt to this changing climate. So it's really important to pay attention to it, because the pace is so remarkable. It's absolutely the wrong thing to do to ignore it. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that.
I could not possibly agree more with all of that. That was one of it. One thing that I've been very curious about as we talk about climate change, and specifically plant material. So the new USDA hardiness zones came out, and I've been surprised as they've been talking about those. We just had an episode with Mary Shear, who is my Northern Garden. She's really knowledgeable about these things, but the folks who made the maps have, it seems to me, have gone out of their way to make sure that they state over and over that this is not, the map changes aren't climate change related specifically. It's just better data, and there's more information kinds of things. Like, it's been shocking to me that they haven't just come out and said that this is climate change in action. This is what we're seeing, because it now means that plants that have been native to, we'll say, southern Minnesota prairies are not necessarily going to have the climate there to support native plants, which changes all of our ecosystems, which changes things completely around. And I'm not quite sure what to do with that.
Yeah. In fact, there's quite a separation you're quite right, in terms of acceptance of the plant hardiness zones and the fact that they're being changed or driven by climate change rather than just data enrichment. Data enrichment is part of the story, but climate change is a big player there. Where you see the opposite is in the hydrologic engineering and all the manuals, because our precipitation is changing so dramatically. That's climate change driven. That is absolutely climate change. And if you want to write a manual for how to put in a storm sewer system for Shakopee that can handle a 10-inch 24-hour rain, you better be referring to the latest edition of the hydrologic manual, because that's got all the recent data in it. If you're using something that's 20 or 30 years old, you're lost, you know, because you've got to keep up with how the climate is changing. And the same thing's true, I think, in our lifetime yet, although I'm 77, so I don't know how many more years I got, but certainly in your lifetime, we're probably going to continue to see changes in the plant hardiness zones. And those changes are going to continue to be made because of the changing climate. And we've got to accept that and figure ways to manage that. I think that's just...
Could not agree more.
The other wild card in all this is, as the climate changes, especially with respect to our native environment, our native species, our planned landscaping with plants or our gardening, is invasive species. Oh my God. What's in store for us with this changing climate in terms of what we're going to see come to Minnesota in terms of invasive species, whether you talk about insects or disease spores or even soil microbes? You could get a whole population of different organisms that in the next 10 years, you're going to be dealing with a whole different mess than what you've dealt with earlier in your life.
Right, absolutely. And there's been study after study, like just on invasive weeds and noxious weeds, as to what they, like the study, I believe it was on poison ivy, that poison ivy grows, is taking advantage of climate change, and it's growing like 30% faster and gets, I'll find the study and put it in the show notes when I post it. But it's just, there's so many implications that are coming at us that are going to change how we live on a day-to-day basis. You think about this summer and the fires in Canada are very much climate change related. And it released a report today that it was equivalent of smoking 70 cigarettes because Minnesota and specifically the metro had some of the worst air quality in the world because of those fires. And so, Mark, I know you got to go. So I just want to be respectful of your time. So thank you very much for being here. Is there anything Minnesota weather, climate related that I didn't ask you that you wanted to make sure that people know about?
Well, I just emphasized the point I made earlier in our conversation, Brad, about this amplified variability. We, as part of our resilience planning, as part of our adaptive planning to coping with this, we need to be very, very aware of how the swings are wider than they used to be. You know what I mean? So we can have a run of mild springs with early starts, warm soil temperatures, all the conditions that rev us up to get out there and get going. And then the very next year, we can have a spring like 2014, where all of a sudden we're having freeze after freeze after freeze after freeze. We're having a wetness that prohibits us from even working in the soils for a long period of time. It can be these wild swings. And we use the term now when we talk about drought climatology. Because of these wild swings and this amplified variability, they're now using these terms in climatology called flash drought, where drought comes into play in a short period of time, because when you go dry so dramatically that in weeks you get to a critically dry period where your fire danger's up, your soil moisture's down, your crops failing. In what used to take historically, more than a month to get there, you're compressing that into a shorter period of time. Similarly, when you recover and the climate switches the other way, you can go so surplus moisture that all of a sudden, like in 2012, where we had 57 Minnesota counties declared for drought disaster, and at the same moment in time, 13 of those 57 counties were simultaneously declared for flood disasters.
Wow.
So you see, you can have the polar opposites of federally declared disasters because the climate variability has changed so remarkably.
Got it. We are missing our buffers. That is definitely right. For sure. So perfect. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us and share just your immense knowledge. So Mark Seely, thank you very, very much for being here. I appreciate your time and have a great rest of your night.
And you too, Brad. Thank you.
Thank you.
See what I mean? I was just in awe about the entire conversation talking with Mark Seely. A, we did it on video, and so I got to put the name, the voice with the face, and it was just really great to experience that personally because I've listened to Mark Seely for a long time on Minnesota Public Radio, and I hope you enjoyed it as well. If you want to see my dumbfounded face often as we talked, you can go to our YouTube channel. We have the video of the interview posted up there right now, and we also have a lot of special treats and awesome things going on at Minnesota Gardening Club. Coming up is a winter workshop that if you go to minnesotagardening.com, you can sign up for the workshop where we're going to talk all about winter sowing. And right before Christmas here, if you still need a gift for someone, you can get a gift membership of the Minnesota Gardening Club for just $47 at minnesotagardening.shop. So I hope to see you there in the Minnesota Gardening Club, and I'll talk to you again next week.